In our study this evening, we're going to see that the consequences of sin are usually not immediately obvious to us. It becomes obvious later on. I think most of us know that intuitively, most of us understand that in principle, but we're going to see that actually illustrated in our study this evening. Divorces are like that. I think most of us are aware that usually people do not get married and then intentionally plan to move towards divorce. That's not the way it works. The way it works is usually one person is offended. It's usually something really small. We always joke about the toothpaste. Somebody didn't roll it up right. But usually it's something simple. It usually is something trivial. A little offense. But the problem is usually that one partner doesn't forgive. Or they might forgive somewhat, and then another little thing happens, and then another little thing happens, and then another little thing happens, and it builds. And after a while, the person is unwilling to forgive. It didn't work out the way they wanted. The root problem really is pride. The root problem really is we are proud people, and we want it our way. In counseling, I often ask people, is it a need that you have that your partner does it this way, or is it a desire? Always amazed how often people say it's a need. In truth, there's only a couple of needs we have. That is, need to breathe, and you need to have water, and you need to have food, and almost everything else is a desire. But yet, it's amazing how many needs people come up with. And what ends up happening is that we distort the concept of a desire into a demand. It's something I want, and so it ends up being a demand. And before you know it, the couple is divorced because of demands of one partner on another partner. And after a while, the other partner starts to figure out that you're upset and you're making these demands. So you end up with this big war and a tragedy occurs and divorce happens. And that's usually the sequence. Well, this truth, we're going to find out, shows up in our study. So that the consequences of sin, a little thing maybe at the beginning, if it isn't dealt with correctly, shows up later on as being a big problem. And we're going to see that in our study. Our study is Esther chapter 3, verse 1 through chapter 4, verse 17. And we're going to start, obviously, with chapter 3, verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1 through verse 6 is Haman's plot. So let's get into our study and let's read the first verse. It says, "And after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him." So the verse is really simple. It says, after these events, and then it tells us that King Ahasuerus promoted this guy called Haman, and then this guy, we're told, is an Agagite, and he is advanced, and he's like second in command in the kingdom. So that's essentially the verse. So this Haman guy that's an Agagite, he ends up being second in command just below the king. So I want you to notice the first three words of the verse. It says, after these events. And you say, like what events? Well, it's chapter 1 and chapter 2. And specifically, it's thinking about chapter 2. And what I want to draw your attention to is that there's been 5 years elapse between chapter 2 and chapter 3. It always is amazing to me how you get these time gaps and we're never told about the time gap, typically. However, in the book of Esther, we are given some information that helps us figure out there's a time gap. Sometimes in Scripture, the time gaps are enormous, like thousands of years. Sometimes it's not as much. Sometimes, actually, the time gaps occur in the middle of a verse. From one word to another word, we saw that when we went through our study in the book of Daniel. Here in Esther, we're told in chapter 1, verse 3, we're told it's the third year of the king's reign. That is King Ahasuerus. We found out already that is Xerxes I. In chapter 2, verse 16, we were already told that it's the seventh year of the king's reign. So that means there was a four-year gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. When we come to our chapter, we'll find out when we get to verse 7 that this is the 12th year of the king's reign. So that means there's a five-year gap between chapter 2 and chapter 3. And then we're going to find out later on when we get into chapter 9, verse 1, it's the 13th year of the king's reign, and there's only 10 chapters to Esther. And the last chapter is really, really, really short. What we're being told is that there's only 1 year left from here now to the end of the book of Esther. So in reality, we've gone from chapter 1, verse 1, to chapter 3, verse 1, and we have already gone through 9 years. And the rest of the book now is only 1 year. So just it's amazing to think about all the time that's already elapsed. And then we have the bulk of the book left, and it's only 1 year to go, okay? So this is the 12th year of the king's reign. 5 years has elapsed since chapter 2. So when it says, after these events, after 5 years has elapsed. And then we're told that there's this guy that gets promoted. There's this man that gets promoted. His name is Haman, and he's an Agagite. Well, before I talk about the fact that Haman is an Agagite, I just want to make the point that this means then that we are in the year of 474 BC, a little bit past halfway through Xerxes the first reign. So now let's talk about what does it mean, what's significant about the fact that Haman is an Agagite? Well, in order for us to understand the significance of this, and by the way, it is significant. Scripture doesn't just drop the fact that he's an Agagite in there just for us to go, oh, okay, information, let's keep going. It's important. If we were studying the book of Exodus and then Deuteronomy and then 1 Samuel, we would find out that there's a problem being an Agagite. There's an issue with the fact that Haman is an Agagite. That's a big deal when it comes to the book of Esther. You got to understand the fact that Haman's an Agagite in order to understand what's going on in chapter 3 and chapter 4. So I want you to understand what's going on. Well, if you were to look at the Exodus, here's a map on the screen. Somebody did a really nice job with this map. I checked it out. It has a lot of detail on it and it's very accurate detail, unlike a lot of maps you might find on the internet. They actually sell this map, so if you're interested for your library, this is a great map to go by. What they show on this map is the Exodus starting from Goshen. And it goes all the way across what we call the Red Sea, or actually it's the Gulf of Aqaba. And they are putting Mount Sinai into Arabia. Now that's consistent with what Paul says in his epistles. And I actually believe that that's where the actual Mount Sinai is. There's also been some research that's been done in recent years that creates a real question as to whether or not Mount Sinai is in the historic place down on the peninsula. I do not believe that it belongs there. I believe Mount Sinai actually is in Arabia. Then the Israelites tried to go into the Promised Land going up to Kadesh Barnea into an area that's known as Amalek. Some Amalekites were in that area. In fact, the Amalekites actually were in a broader area. They actually occupied a fairly significant geographic area. And what this map shows is that the Israelites couldn't go that way, so they end up going back along the east side of the Jordan River, and then they cut across to get into the Promised Land. And that's exactly what Scripture tells us they did. Very, very, very nice map. I've never seen a map quite so detailed and so accurate. But what's important and what I want you to see on this chart is a group of people called Amalekites. With that, I want you to go now to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 8. So the Amalekites would have been in the region that the Israelites went through as they left Egypt and they went to the Promised Land. And if you look at Exodus chapter 17 verse 8, you find out that there's a group called Amalek. It shows up in verse 8. So Exodus chapter 17, verse 8 says, "And then Amalek came and they fought against Israel at Rephidim." Now, if you go and look at the map, you find out that Rephidim is in Saudi Arabia. So verse 8 says, "And then Amalek came, and they fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. And tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands.' Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it came about when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, then Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. And then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other, and thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this in a book, as mentioned, and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven.'" What does God say that he's going to do? He's going to eliminate him. He's going to utterly destroy the Amalekites. "And Moses built an altar, named it, 'The Lord is my banner.' And he said, 'The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation.'" The message is that God is going to have war against Amalek from generation to generation to generation, and then finally eliminate him. Okay? That's what this is all about. Now look at Deuteronomy 25. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 25. And look at verse 17. You find another reference to the Amalekites. And here, Moses is speaking, and he says, "Remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt." So what's Moses saying? Remember that group of people called Amalekites? They tried to stop us. I mean, they caused us trouble. Verse 18, "And how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear." In other words, they attacked him from the back. "And when you were faint and weary, he did not fear God. Therefore, it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget." What does God say? Now, when you get in the land, what are you supposed to do? Well, wipe them out. That's what Moses tells them that God wants them to do. Go wipe them out. All right, so let's go to 1 Samuel now. 1 Samuel, you find out that Saul was told to go wipe them out. This is what God wanted done. So Saul, 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 7 says, "So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he captured Agag." Now, what did we just find out? Haman was a what? An Agagite, right? Here's Agag. He's a king. So he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. So already you see that there's a connection, right? There's a connection between Haman, a descendant of King Agag. That's the royal line. So watch this. Haman's part of the royal line of King Agag. He's an Agagite. He's connected to the Amalekites. And what did God want Israel to do to the Amalekites? Wipe them out. Verse 8, "So he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag." Oh, they got everybody but who? The king. "And the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed." So what did they do? They destroyed everything that nobody wanted. And they kept the good stuff. And what were they told to do? Well, wipe them out. Verse 20. "And then Saul said to Samuel, 'I did obey the voice of the Lord, and I went on the mission on which the Lord sent me. And I brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil.'" sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of lambs. For rebellion, that's what Saul did. For rebellion is as the sin of divination. In other words, divination's really bad, right? What Samuel is saying is that rebellion is just like you committed the sin of divination. You think divination's really, really bad, Saul. Guess what? Rebellion is too. And insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. And because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Why? He did not wipe out the Amalekites. He spared King Agag. And so guess what happens? 500 years later, a descendant of King Agag shows up in the capital of Susa of the Assyrian Empire, and King Xerxes I makes him second in command. And this is a descendant of King Agag. And he's an Agagite. And what did God want done? God wanted the Israelites to do what? Wipe them all out. God wanted them to wipe them all out. So watch this. There's been bad blood between these two groups. Remember the Amalekites did what? They attacked Israel's rear as they left Egypt and tried to go into the promised land. And so they've been at war with one another. So the fact that all of a sudden Haman is an Agagite and he's second in command in the empire sets up our story, tells us that there's trouble coming, because we happen to know something right now that Haman did not know when he got the position. But we today, because we can look back, we know that trouble is coming. Verse 2. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Well, what's the point? Well, the point is that the king, King Xerxes I, had ordered that everybody was to bow down and pay homage to this guy called Haman. And what did Mordecai do? He didn't do that. He refused to do that. The Hebrew text actually implies repeated bowing down, repeatedly doing homage. So the idea, apparently, is that every time they saw Haman, they were supposed to bow down. Not necessarily like worship, although bowing down is like worship. And we believe that that's why Mordecai probably did not bow down. Now, there's some differences of view, but I personally believe that explains why he did not do that, because what were the Jews told to do? They were to worship what? Only one God. Verse 3, and then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, well, why are you transgressing the king's command? Well, what this tells us is that the king's servants noticed that Mordecai wasn't bowing down. Everybody else is, but not Mordecai. Mordecai isn't doing this, and so what are they doing? They're saying, Mordecai, you're supposed to bow down. Verse 4, and now it was when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them. What that says right away is that every day they were saying, Mordecai, you're supposed to bow down. Then the next day, hey, Mordecai, you're supposed to bow down. And then the next day, hey, Mordecai, you're supposed to bow down. And each day, Mordecai, you're supposed to bow down. And what was Mordecai doing? He never bowed down. He never bowed down. And they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. What we weren't told earlier is that Mordecai had given this reason to the king's servants when the king's servants were telling him he needed to bow down. What we weren't told is that he had explained to them that he was a Jew. Doesn't show up until verse 4. And so that's the reason Mordecai isn't bowing down, is that he's a Jew, he worships, and we're not told this either, but he worshiped one God. Showed honor to only God, not Haman. Verse 5, and when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. What a bad, bad deal. He's filled with rage. The idea is that he's livid. He's furious. And we know what happens when somebody's in a position of power and they're angry. Bad things happen. Verse 6. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Now, the New American Standard says disdain. ESV says disdain. A number of Bible translations really reword this whole verse. So it's a little difficult to get a good feel for what's going on. The actual Hebrew word disdain has the idea that he looked down on. So the idea is that Haman felt superior to Mordecai, and so we're told that he feels superior to him and he doesn't want to lay hands on him alone. So the idea is almost like he doesn't want to touch him. He doesn't want to be bothered with him. He just looks down on the guy. What does that tell you about the attitude of this Agagite towards a Jew? I suspect that as soon as Haman understood that this was a Jew, all of the attitudes from the past are in full swing in this man's emotions. And he's got disdain for this Jew. Can't stomach this guy. So he isn't going to go and deal with him directly, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. That is, he was Jew. And therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So what's Haman's solution? So rather than killing him, I'm just going to kill everybody. I'll just get rid of all these Jews. Sins of the past become issues in the future. Like in divorce. Sins of the past becomes issues in the future. Verse 7. Verse 7 now is the beginning of Haman's plot. We already know what he wants to do. He wants to kill all the Jews. He wants to eliminate the Jews. That's his plan. So verse 7 says, and in the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot. What we're being told there when we're saying poor, the word poor means lot. I don't mean P-O-O-R, I mean P-U-R. That was the Persian name for lot. Was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month. That is the month Adar. Now you might wonder, what's Nisan and what's Adar? Well, I thought I might just talk about Nisan and Adar for a second just to give you a feel for what Adar and Nisan's all about. On the screen, I have the Jewish calendar in the 5th century. By the way, the Jewish calendar today has a different order. Back in that time, Trishi was actually the first month in the sequence, but you follow the calendar that's up here on the screen, Nisan's first, and then you walk right through the months, you come back around Tishri, and then you keep on going, and Adar is the last month. The best way to understand verse 7 is that Haman's trying to figure out is which month is the best month to kill all the Jews. He's trying to figure out when is the best month. So he's using the lot. I went looking. I discovered in my research that the Persian lot was actually a quadrangular prism. What we do not know is, was this the prism that was actually thrown repeatedly until Haman figured out that the month of Adar was the right month in which to exterminate all the Jews. What we are told by archaeologists is that the numbers of 1, 2, and 5, and 6 have been found on the quadrangular prism that was found in the Persian area. As I was thinking about this, what would have happened if he had thrown the lot and it happened to be in 2 weeks? Kill all the Jews in 2 weeks, that'd be fast. No one could get a chance to prepare. Even more interesting is that Esther and Mordecai would have probably been in trouble trying to put their plan together. Isn't it great that it ended up being 12 months later? That's lots of time to prepare. Lots of time to counteract this. I do not believe that this just happened by happenstance. I do not believe that the Jews just lucked out, as we would say today. Look at Proverbs chapter 16, verse 33. Interesting verse. Proverbs 16, 33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." You know what I think happened, and Haman didn't know it? God was directing that lot. God was in total control. Haman had no idea that God was controlling that lot. Have you ever seen a Star Wars movie with some Jedi? And I remember in this particular movie that somebody throws some lot, and it's over the purchase or the rescue of somebody who's like a slave. Lot is thrown, and the Jedi waves his hand, and all of a sudden that lot just kind of rolls in the right place. He gets what he wants. I don't think God had to wave his hand. God just controlled the lot and ended up in the right place. Verse 8 now is about the king and Haman. So Haman now makes it to the king. We're told, "And then Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, and their laws are different from all of those of all the other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, and so it's not in the king's interest to let them remain.'" What did he just do? He just got through making the point that there's a certain people, and what does he not say? Who the certain people are? Certain people. Now, if you were the king and you just appointed this guy as your second in command, and he comes in, there's these certain people, I think there's a certain amount of trust. You don't put somebody in a second in command unless you trust the person. There's trust between Xerxes I, or King Ahasuerus, and Haman. So when Haman walks in and says there's these certain people, I suspect King Ahasuerus didn't even think anything about it. They're all throughout the province of your kingdom, and their laws are different, and they don't observe your laws, king. That sounds bad. Today, we're told that there are terrorists in every state in the Union. Every state in the United States, there are terrorist groups, lots of them. I mean, we at least have an idea as to who they are. Haman doesn't even identify the people, but they're everywhere, right? And the idea is that this is bad, and we need to eliminate them. Verse 9, "And if it's pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay you 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put it in the king's treasury." And so what's he saying? Well, he has a proposal. First of all, Haman's plot or Haman's proposal is, first is that we destroy them, get rid of them. Because why? What motivated this plot? One guy refused to bow down to Haman. Who was that? Mordecai. Watch this. One guy motivates the elimination of every Jew in the kingdom. Talk about revenge. Revenge in the heart. And then the second part of the proposal is 10,000 talents of silver will be put into the king's treasury. Well, somebody did some calculations, and they've come up with the conclusion that that's equivalent to 375 tons of silver. And they also drew the conclusion that that equals two-thirds of the annual income of the Assyrian Empire while King Xerxes I was in control. Now, that's a lot of money that Haman's offering the king. And where do you think he got the money? Was he independently wealthy? No, you're going to find out he's going to take it from the Jews. He's going to kill them, and then he's going to take the spoils from their houses and from their whatever financial resources they had and going to put it into the king's treasuries. We can suspect that Haman also probably skimmed a percentage off the top himself. I'm sure this wasn't all just going to the king. He's going to get a little kickback himself. Verse 10. And then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews. So right up front, we're told he's the enemy of the Jews. So now we're told he's the enemy of the Jews. And that's right. That's exactly what he is. He's the enemy of the Jews. This is old sins. Old sins blossom in the future. It's like a flower. It's like planting seed in the ground. You water it and you water it and you water it, and what ends up happening? It sprouts. That's what happens with sin that's not dealt with. How should we deal with sin in our own life? And if we don't deal with sin in our own life, what's the potential result in the future? If we don't deal with sin in our life now, it can be like a flower in the future. By God's good grace, I think God mitigates a lot of our sin. But there's obviously some sins that God allows to go forward and become an issue. Remember in the Old Testament, we're told that the sins of the fathers are passed on to the third and the fourth and the fifth generation. There are some sins that God allows to have a result in the future. And so we see this man called Haman, and he's about ready to, at least he thinks he's going to anyway, destroy all the Jews and get wealthy in the process. Verse 11. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours and the people also, to do with them as you please." Huh! If you're Haman, you just got everything you wanted. You get to go kill these people that you hate, get rid of Mordecai, who you disdain, can't stomach, and you get rich in the process. Verse 12. And then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were from each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. And letters were sent to couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all of the Jews. I think that's really interesting. Listen to all the three verbs: to destroy, and to kill, and to annihilate. So just in case we weren't sure they were going to be killed, all of them, we get destroy and kill and annihilate. The idea is that he wants to eliminate them all, both young and old and women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. The copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. And the couriers went out and impelled by the king's command while the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa. And while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. So the edict goes out, king and Haman sit down, they have a drink, and everybody's in confusion and people are in panic. And they're having a good time. What a sad picture. Haman has absolutely no heart for people. Couldn't help but think about the way we treat our babies. We just murder them and people sit and they have lunch and they talk about murdering the babies and chopping up their bodies and selling their bodies, and been hearing that on the news. It's like Haman going to annihilate, kill, and destroy all the Jews, and what's he doing? He's sitting with the king enjoying a drink. Sad news. Chapter 4, verse 1. Haman now discovers about the plot. And when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. What's he doing? Mourning. Standard process for mourning. But this isn't a show. This isn't a paid deal. This is a real deal. He's really in mourning. Because not only has he revealed that he's a Jew, which now means he will die, but what they can also now figure out is that Esther's a Jew. Because Esther and Mordecai are connected. And so Mordecai is a Jew. Now they know that Esther is a Jew. That's bad news. Verse 2. And he went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. At first, this is a little confusing, but if you look down at verse 6, it explains what's going on. It says, so Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. So the idea here is that there's a city, there's a palace connected to the city, and there's a gate between the palace and the city. Here's a layout of Susa. I was stunned. I was actually able to find an archaeologist layout of the city of Susa with the palace. The palace is actually up here in, I guess, what we would call the northwest quadrant of the city. This is the ruins. So archaeologists have been doing some digging. They figured out that this is the layout of the city, and the palace is actually sitting up here. So what we're being told is that Mordecai isn't in the palace. He's in the city, and he can't go through the gate to get into the palace, is what we're being told. Now it makes sense to me when I read verse 2 as to what's happening. So he's at the king's gate, but he can't go in because he's in sackcloth, okay? Verse 3. And in each and every province where the command and the decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Everybody's mourning. I was thinking to myself, why don't the people now just run? I mean, it's 12 months. I mean, everybody could just get up and run, go someplace, save themselves. Well, if you think about how big the kingdom was, I mean, it's like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles to escape. This is like the place to live. And where are you going to go? If you're a Jew, do you go back to Israel? Well, his territory included Israel. So where could you go to escape? I'm sure that there are some who left. Most of them probably figured it doesn't make a lot of sense to try to run. We're still going to die no matter where we go. Verse 4. Now Esther finally finds out about what's happening. And we're told, and then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. And she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. Now, why is the queen doing this? Well, I think the reason she's doing this is so that he can come in. Remember, we were just told that he's in sackcloth, so he can't go through the gate, right? So she wants to give him clothes so he can come in, they can talk. And then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So she's looking for information. Verse 6, we've already read. Verse 7, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. So what does Mordecai do with Hathach? Mordecai tells Hathach exactly what's going on. And he also gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. So Mordecai is being proactive. Mordecai is trying to get Esther to go in to save everybody. Okay, that's the picture. I thought it was interesting. He gives her a copy of the edict. When we think of a copy, we think of a piece of paper like this. In those days, it was probably a clay tablet with diagrams and little things all over it. That would have been the copy of the edict. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. And then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. So the queen hears, understands what's going on. And so Esther now tells Hathach, well, go back to Mordecai and tell him what the problem is. And she says, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live, and I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. So the message is that what happens if Esther just shows up? She could end up dead, is the point. I just can't go popping in there because I might actually end up dead. Verse 12, and they related Esther's words to Mordecai. The Greek historian Herodotus, in one of his documents, actually confirms that what Esther tells Mordecai here in verse 11 is actually true. It's interesting that you have secular history corroborating what Scripture actually says, verse 13. And then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews." What's he saying? They know that you're a Jew. You can't escape no more than we are going to be able to escape if you do nothing. "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And you, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" And the answer is what? Yes. God put her in this spot for such a time as this. So what does she do? Well, she calls them to fast, verse 15, 16, and 17. And then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." And so Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. There are three basic types of fasting in the Bible. One is where you just deny yourself tasty food. We've done fasting here at the church. Usually what we do is we encourage people just to deny yourself something that you really like chocolate, something you really, really, really like, or a bunch of things you really, really like. Another kind is the kind that Jesus did, where he just denied himself food. What she's asking for is no water, no food. That's significant fact. This is serious time. Well, we're going to pick our story up next time, but there's something important here. What did Mordecai tell her? Is that God put her in the place for such a time as this? And the answer is, that's right. You know what God did? Before they even knew there was a need, God had already provided the solution. Already put her in the right spot. And you know what God does in our life? Watch this. God already knew you're going to have a problem. And all the resources to solve the problem are already there. We just need to trust the Lord and say thank you.